From NPR News, this is the podcast of the best of weekends on All Things Considered, the highlights from our shows this weekend. I'm David Greene, in for Guy Raz. Mid-August seems like a good time to talk about football with teams from high school to the pros deep into practice and getting ready for the season. But there's a cloud hanging over this fall. Never have the devastating effects of concussion injuries been more clear.
You cannot find an activity that people are voluntarily letting children participate in that exposes them to over 2,000 hits to the head in a short period of time.
A conversation about football. Plus, we celebrate two anniversaries. The legendary Mexican comic Cantinflas would have just celebrated his 100th birthday. And it's been 50 years since the sizzling summer of 61. Two New York Yankees were in a home run race.
We thought Roger Maris was terrific. We hoped that he would hit 59 and Mickey would hit 61.
You'll hear how reindeer helped win World War II, also comedian Aziz Ansari and comic crusader Grant Morrison, who looked for literary inspiration in an unexpected place.
So I went a bit nutty at 30 and decided to do a lot of the stuff that I hadn't ever tried, like drinking and cross-dressing, for instance.
We'll bring you the Midwestern music of the Bottle Rockets and also the sound from inside a Virginia taxi. Take a ride in the karaoke cab.
I want to lay you down on a bed of roses.
That's all coming up on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. For many of us, this is the sound of the season. Football is back. The NFL lockout is history. Teams at all levels are deep into practice. But there's a cloud hanging over this season. Never before have the devastating effects of concussions been so clear. In the NFL, last year, the toll was obvious.
Oh, man, a hit! Oh, Gideon is hurt. He is knocked out.
Oh, big hit! Deshaun Jackson.
He did not see that hit coming.
He hasn't moved since he took that hit.
The offseason brought another brutal reminder. Dave Duerson, the hard-hitting former Chicago Bear, committed suicide, and one factor cited was the brain trauma he suffered on the field. Our cover story today, football, finding the balance between safety and playing to win. We'll start with the story of a high school star from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
My name's Spencer Helgren. I'm a offensive guard and defensive tackle for the Westwood Patriots. I'm from West Ishpeming, and I'm 17 years old.
Spencer's a senior now. In the third quarter of a game late last season, he took a head-to-head hit.
I didn't think anything of it, just normal, got my bell rung. It happens.
A few plays later, a blocker knocked him over.
And I fell on the ground, and I hit my elbow, and that hurt, and I started crying. No, I'm not the kind of person that cries ever. I mean, I'm, you know, usually that guy that's kind of like a wall that, you know, you'd never be able to tell if I'm hurt or anything. Just fight through the pain, you know. You got a job to do when you do it. But I started bawling my eyes out.
The trainer gave him a few simple tests.
I looked to be fine, except for the fact that I was an emotional roller coaster. I wasn't fine at all.
And this is what medical professionals are trying to teach coaches. There are so many different signs of a concussion injury, and they need to know all of them. Jamie Dubose coaches the Prattville High Lions in Alabama. They are ranked number one in the nation this season by Rivals.com. Coach Dubose says he's changed the way he handles his players.
If it's a head injury, we don't risk. We don't go any further. It's a shutdown method, and that's what we've been told as far as the High School Athletic Association and all the doctors that have educated us on it.
Well, you said you're going to be potentially going overboard. I guess I'm wondering how often do you think you'll be making decisions about a player, you know, how many times in a game or how many times in a season that you wouldn't have made, you know, 2, 4, 10 years ago?
Well, I know we had a scrimmage Friday night. This just coming recently, and we had a kid to take a very big shot on the sideline on a kick return, kind of got blindsided a little bit with a legal hit, but he was scrambled a little bit, and we went ahead and shut him down. And I'm thinking, you know, if I would have been just a coach 10, 15 years ago, that player probably would have been back out there playing again.
And, Coach, I guess there just seems to be this real fundamental tension here as we talk about this between – you know, safety and then this you know, the old school football tradition. You get hit, you get up, and you go out and you hit back harder. How do you find the right balance?
I can remember the days of somebody laying on the ground, and that showed that you wasn't a very tough person if you wasn't laying on the ground. I'll be honest with you, I was at that youth clinic yesterday, and a kid was complaining, a little kid, I'm first grade maybe or something. I was standing over on the side, and he went over to get some water from his mom during a drill, and I heard the mom, the mother of all people, say, "You got to suck it up and get back out there." Well, you know, I mean, that mentality sometimes needs to be changed, I guess, is, you know, the kids are told maybe at home that, you know, you're not hurt. I remember when I played, I got a concussion one time and came to the sideline, and my dad was like, "Oh, he's all right. Get him back out there. Get him back out there." But we didn't know till later I had a concussion. And I think the old school of thumb is, you know, if you are a sign of weakness, so to speak, if you're on the sideline. But we're trying to educate them that it's not a sign of weakness. It's just a sign of, let's make sure you're taken care of to get back out there as quick as you can.
Jamie Dubose is head coach of the Prattville Lions in Prattville, Alabama. Thanks for joining us, and have a good season.
Thank you.
Now, back in Michigan, Spencer Helgren's coaches were adamant that after his concussion, he couldn't play until he got medical clearance. He did, the day before the next game, the season finale. Since he missed most of the week's practice, he wasn't allowed to start.
I was a little, I don't know, angry just because, well, 3 years I've been starting both ways. I haven't missed a game. And then here we are now. I got a little bump on the head, and now I have to sit out.
Then late in the third quarter, Spencer went into the game. And as usual, he tangled with a big offensive lineman, and he got hit.
It was head-on-head contact with another player, which the guy across from me had to have been at least 300 pounds. You know, he was a big fella. I was kind of zigzagging over to the sideline.
Spencer sat down on the bench. The team's trainer delivered the news. He was out of the game.
That's what started the six-month, 24-hour-a-day splitting headache that never went away. I started getting really sensitive to light. I couldn't concentrate or focus. I'm trying to do school because this was during school. And, you know, straight-A student, you know, my whole life. When I started, you know, really hitting the books again, I couldn't read, you know, a book anymore. I enjoyed reading. I couldn't look at a book and read from top to bottom and remember what I read in the middle.
Chris Nowinski understands these symptoms firsthand. He suffered 6 concussions as a college player and then a professional WWE wrestler. Now he's co-director of a brain research center at Boston University, focusing on a disease that's known as CTE.
There was a study that came out of the University of Illinois that put sensors in the helmets of high school players for a few years. The average high school player took over 800 blows to the head at a minimum threshold of 15 Gs, which is not a small hit. There was one poor kid who took 2,235 hits to the head in one season.
In one high school season?
One high school season. When you step back, and now that we're finally starting to quantify this, you cannot find an activity that people are voluntarily letting children participate in that exposes them to over 2,000 hits to the head in a short period of time. And the reality is when you find CTE in 18-year-old kids, in Owen Thomas, the 21-year-old co-captain of the Penn football team that committed suicide last year, mm-hmm. when you're finding it in guys that are supposed to be fine, and they played fine, and they played all the fundamentals right, clearly the fundamentals and everything that, you know, every habit that we've had has been the problems.
How do coaches change the fundamentals without changing the sport of football?
If you look at, say, a kid who's taking 2,000 hits to the head, the data will say that 1,200 of those hits come in practice. Well, practice, nobody's keeping score and nobody cares. And so the reality is you could virtually eliminate almost all of those 1,200 hits just by reinventing how we practice the game of football to not involve collisions. We've been working with a number of youth football programs through Sports Legacy that have virtually eliminated hitting from practice and discovered, miraculously, that they can still win games and they still are playing just as well.
What is your guidance to sort of the sport and people who love it this year? I mean, can they be excited? Are these new dangerous times? Based on everything you've learned, what would you say?
I think you can still be excited about football, and there's still a number of aspects about football that are magical and terrific to get fired up about that don't involve the risk of people having lifetime trauma.
You know these symptoms firsthand. You suffered, I think, 6 concussions of your own. Is that right?
Well, 6 concussions in my 20s. I have no idea what I suffered as a child.
Do you ever think about sort of what might develop 10, 20, 30 years from now? I mean, if you might have CTE from your concussions and sort of what your future might hold?
Well, the reality is I certainly think there's a very strong risk. I have it already progressing in my brain. I'm actually one of our guinea pigs for a lot of our advanced imaging studies and things to try to find a diagnostic. And the best news I got in a small pilot study of five of us on some imaging is I was the least abnormal. But the reality is also that, you know, CTE is not, you know, I look on the bright side that there have been guys in our brain bank who've had CTE who also lived very normal lives. So I think, you know, if it is occurring in my brain, it's just something I have to deal with. And it keeps me motivated to go find that treatment that we all need.
That's Chris Nowinski. He's co-founder and president of the Sports Legacy Institute. And he spoke to us from member station WBUR in Boston. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The thing is, young men like Spencer Helgren in Michigan, they grow up dreaming of football.
For one, you know, the love of the game. I'm not the kind of person that likes playing football because I like to hit people, okay? That's kind of like a, I guess, an added bonus, you know? But I'm the kind of person where I love the game. It's, I love the teamwork, I love the effort, I love the work, you know? And it's just, I love the game.
That's why so many people are trying to find a way to make the game safer. People like researcher Stefan Duma of Virginia Tech University. Duma did a study of football helmets, and he found that the most popular helmet in the NFL last season ranked second from the bottom in terms of safety.
That's the VSR-4, and that's kind of the historical, almost the workhorse of college and professional football, if you will. A lot of teams have it. A lot of teams keep using it. A lot of the players in the NFL grew up with that helmet, and so they want to keep it.
I do want to underline this, though. I mean, a very large number of NFL players are wearing a helmet that you've given one star to that you say basically is really creates a risk of concussion injury.
There's no question if you're in the VSR-4, you have a significantly higher, almost double the risk of concussion than the newer, better helmets. And even here at Virginia Tech, we had this problem. Last year, about half of our team had this older VSR-4, which we gave a one star. So as soon as we finalized the results, you know, I called Dr. Brolinson, Mike Goforth, and we had a very quick conversation, and we agreed that simply we're going to get rid of all the old helmets, and all of our players are going to be in the new best five-star helmet this fall.
We've been learning about the research into football helmets from Professor Stefan Duma at Virginia Tech University. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
As far as Spencer Helgren up in Michigan, he's at football practice.
Right now, I'm fully back. This is our first week of two-a-days. And I'm loving every minute of it.
And he's not changing a thing about his game.
It's when you hold back and you're thinking, ooh, I might hit my head on this play, is where you're going to hit your head, you know? When you start holding back and kind of fear, you can actually put yourself in danger.
Years ago today, Tossin' and Turnin' was topping the charts, and New York sports fans were in their glory. Two Yankees sluggers, Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris, were closing in on Babe Ruth's elusive record of 60 home runs in a season. On this very day in 1961, the M&M boys both hit number 45 during a doubleheader against the Washington Senators. There was no doubt, longtime Yankee Mickey Mantle was the fans' favorite.
Well, kids, baseball season's here again. And with Post Serials baseball trading cards, you can get a rundown on all your favorite players.
Hey, he talked to me. Mickey Mantle talked to me.
Even teammates had trouble remaining impartial.
I think there was a little tension in our clubhouse. And I think there were some that were pulling for Mickey and maybe one or two that roomed right by Roger that were pulling for him to break it.
That's Bobby Richardson, who played second base for the 61 Yankees. While Bobby was on the field at Yankee Stadium, another Bobby, a rabid 9-year-old fan, was following the drama across the river in Queens.
The Yankees were the team that was on radio and television in New York. Mickey Mantle was the guy, so they became my team.
That's Bob Costas, who, as an adult, has made a career out of capturing the poetry of sports. These two voices, Costas and former player Bobby Richardson, are going to help us remember that sizzling summer of 61. Like most Yankees fans, 9-year-old Bobby Costas was cheering for Mantle.
A lot of people thought, well, if anyone is going to break this record, it should be Mickey Mantle, who's already certified as a first-rate Hall of Fame player.
Mantle had grown up through the farm system, had played in the minor leagues and come up, and he really was a Yankee. So all the teammates were pulling for him in 61 to break the record.
Every young kid my age idolized Mickey Mantle.
Dad, Joanna, this is Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle.
Hello, Roger.
Roger.
Mickey.
Rick.
During the season, Mickey would be out of the lineup for a little bit, and he would be introduced to come in as a pinch hitter, and there'd be an ovation that was absolutely tremendous. And I didn't see that for Roger.
We thought Roger Maris was terrific. We hoped that he would hit 59 and Mickey would hit 61.
When we came to work each day, the press would come in. They'd all go right to Maris and Mantle's locker. Well, Mickey knew how to handle them. He could walk away from them, but Roger was just, because of his shyness and so forth, portrayed in a different light altogether. And so the pressure was on him. He was losing his hair. Mantle, it didn't bother him at all.
You know, he was a guy from Fargo, North Dakota, a guy with little use for all the trappings of fame and celebrity.
I think the problem was that Roger just didn't, he really didn't care too much. And, you know, he was a team player. He wanted us to win. But I don't think personally it was that big a thing with him having a personal record. He just wanted the team to win.
It's kind of instructive when you watch the black and white clip of him hitting his 61st home run.
Two balls, no strikes on Roger Maris. Here's the windup. Fastball hit deep to right.
This is a monumental achievement, and the crowd is saluting him, and his teammates practically have to push him up to the top step of the dugout after he's rounded the bases, and in a brief, awkward, almost sheepish moment, he removes his cap, waves it at the crowd, and then ducks back down. Today, guys take three curtain calls for a sacrifice fly.
But he was just not one to show, not like Reggie Jackson. Reggie would come out and put up 1, 2, 3 when he hit it his. Roger was not that personality at all.
People found out about it in different ways. They learned about it over the radio, or they picked up the newspaper. Seems like a quaint concept. You'd wait for the morning newspaper, saying to yourself, did one of the M&M boys hit one last night, or did they both hit one? You couldn't follow it instantly and see the highlight immediately on the internet or every game on television. So there was more distance from it, and therefore more romance and imagination. It's different.
Now to another landmark celebration. Yesterday would have been the 100th birthday of the Mexican comic legend known as Cantinflas. Charlie Chaplin once called Cantinflas, whose real name was Mario Moreno, the best comedian alive. He died in 1993 after making 50 films, most of them in Spanish. In Hollywood, he won a Golden Globe for his performance in Around the World in 80 Days. Producer Lily Percy looks back.
Mario Moreno was born August 12th. 1911, in a working-class neighborhood in Mexico City called Tepito. He got his start performing in carpas, or tent theaters, Mexico's version of vaudeville. That's when he created the nonsense nickname Cantinflas, and the character that would define him, an endearing, fast-talking vagabond. Cantinflas began his film career in the mid-1930s, but it wasn't until 1940 that he broke out in the movie Allí está el detalle, or There's the Rub.
A movie that if you have never seen Cantinflas would probably be a good place to start.
That's Gregorio Luque. He's an expert in Mexican art and culture based in Long Beach, California.
Cantinflas plays, again, you know, this vagrant lowlife that has a girlfriend who is the maid of a wealthy home. And so you see Cantinflas speaking with the maid, and the maid complains that he doesn't work and that he's just good for nothing and that they will never get married. And Cantinflas responds to her that, who says that work is a virtue? Has she ever seen any rich man work? If working were a good thing, the rich would work too.
His character in the film, also called Cantinflas, talks like Groucho Marx, but looks a little like a famous English movie tramp.
He is the Mexican Charlie Chaplin.
That's Mexican-American writer Sandra Cisneros. She remembers seeing Cantinflas movies as a child with her parents in Chicago.
And, you know, you can never keep up with these Cantinflas movies because it was all about him speaking so quickly. He was famous for cantinfleando, you know, making words and bending them all around. So the audience would laugh, and I got used to these explosions of laughter, not always following the humor, but just watching the story and liking him because he was very likable.
Cantinflas found himself breaking box office records at crowded theaters in Mexico, as well as all over Latin America. Soon Hollywood came knocking, but it wasn't until 1956 that he found a role that let Cantinflas be Cantinflas. The movie was Around the World in 80 Days, and he played the scene-stealing valet to Englishman David Niven.
It's not Sunday. It's Saturday. We have 10 minutes left.
What the everlasting blazes are you jabbering about?
It's Saturday. Look for yourself. It's Saturday.
The film was a smash. It won the Best Picture Oscar that year, and Cantinflas collected the Golden Globe for Best Comic Actor. It was the highlight of his English-language career, but he continued to rule in the Spanish-language world.
The language that Cantinflas uses is really all about puns.
That's University of Minnesota history professor Jeffrey Pilcher. His focus is on Mexican cultural history, and he wrote a book on Cantinflas. And it was those puns, he says, that made Cantinflas so hard to translate for the U.S. market. Not so for audiences outside Mexico, though, from Colombia to Chile.
Because his humor was so chaotic, so incomprehensible, I think it allowed people to, even if they didn't get the specific references from that Mexico City dialect, they sort of placed their own jokes in his mouth.
Cantinflas continued to make movies in English and Spanish well into the 1980s and even earned a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. A year before his death in 1993, the Bible of Spanish language, the Real Academia Española, added a verb in his honor, cantinflar, which means, appropriately, talking without saying anything. And his movies are still a touchstone for Latinos, or, as Jeffrey Pilcher puts it,
sort of the way that The Wizard of Oz is in the United States.
Mario Moreno would have turned 100 years old yesterday. For NPR News, this is Lily Percy.
Estas son las mañanitas que cantaba el rey David a las
Here are two things you probably don't know about World War II.
An ally is in peril, and a lifeline is flung across the top of the world.
Number one, there was a theater of the war at the top of the world, the Arctic.
It is the most expeditious way of feeding embattled Russia from democracy's arsenal.
An Arctic shipping route.
The shortest route.
From North America to the Russian port of Murmansk. The city is above the Arctic Circle, right across the border from the northern tip of Norway. A pristine place.
But for the pregnant ships, the grimmest, the harshest, the cruelest.
And so to the second thing you might not know, once those ships made that grim, harsh, cruel journey to Russia, they got a helping hand from a little-known northern member of the Allied forces.
Is that a reindeer sneeze?
Reindeer.
So his name is Rudolf. He was born on May the 5th. Now he's 2 months old.
I first heard about all of this when I visited Murmansk earlier this year. That's where I found Rudolf and some fellow reindeer eating lunch.
And what are these reindeer eating, Stepan?
At the moment, my microphone. We'll get back to Rudolf. But first, you really got to understand what warfare was like in this icy part of the world.
Hey, I'm David Green.
Tim Francis.
Nice to meet you. Thank you for doing this.
I sat down with U.S. Navy historian Tim Francis. He says 75% of World War II supplies shipped from North America went around the Horn of Africa. But
about 25% went the northern run.
At German air bases in Norway and Finland, detailed reports on convoy movements come in from long-range reconnaissance planes. The Nazis have a magnificently effective plan to change the color of the Arctic from white to red.
Even in the summer, Arctic convoys are difficult to run. The water is always very cold. If you fall in the water, they didn't have the same life suits that we have today. You froze to death very quickly. Storms, rough seas, ice, the tension, the stress level, constant struggles to make headway.
In some convoys, only one half of the ships survived.
German planes would fall out of Norway, you'd have surface raiders, German destroyers, cruisers, battleships would attack on the surface, and then you had U-boats that could attack them from undersea.
If the Germans can choke off the flow of supplies to Russia, munitions, oil, food, the entire Allied cause may face defeat.
But of course, all those supplies didn't just need to get to Murmansk. They needed to get south into Russia.
Reindeer would be like pack animal convoys, just to get stuff out of the danger area and get it to places where people could use it.
Back in Murmansk, aside from Rudolf, I also spent some time in museums learning about the war. Germans were constantly pounding Murmansk, and the city sacrificed thousands of lives to keep that port open. And one museum guide I spoke to, Galina Kulichenka, said there's another part of the story that just can't be forgotten. Reindeer, she says, were so important to the Allied effort, so crucial in hauling supplies. She says Murmansk should put up a reindeer monument.
Animal transport is actually one of those aspects of the entire global war that people don't fully realize.
Again, historian Tim Francis.
People think of mechanized armor divisions from World War II.
Sure.
But the majority of ground combat in Europe was done with infantry on the ground using horses and donkeys. And in the north, it would be reindeer.
Tim Francis is an historian with the U.S. Navy. Now, starting tomorrow on Morning Edition, we'll take you, our listeners, to the Arctic. Turns out countries are in this struggle there for power and influence. We'll tell you all about it this week on NPR. Aziz Ansari is one of the few Indian faces in Hollywood, but his stock in trade isn't ethnic humor. There are other reasons his character on the NBC sitcom Parks and Recreation is so appetizing.
Zerts are what I call desserts. Tray-trays are entrees. I call sandwiches Sammy's, Sandoozles, or Adam Sandler's. Air conditioners are cool blasters with a Z. I don't know where that came from. I call cakes big old cookies. Fried chicken is fry fry chicky chick. Chicken parm is chicky chicky parm parm. Chicken cacciatore, chicky catch. Tortillas are bean blankies. And I call forks food rakes.
That's Aziz Ansari as Tom Haverford in NBC's sitcom Parks and Recreation. The South Carolina-born comedian has his first leading role in a film out this weekend called 30 Minutes or Less. But the 28-year-old actor did not take the typical route to the big screen. Aziz Ansari's path to comedic fame went through NYU's School of Business.
I just started doing stand-up while I was in college, and the summer of my freshman year, which was the summer of 2001, I didn't have any aspirations to be in movies or TV or anything like that. I just liked doing stand-up and wanted to get better at it the same way someone would like to get better at playing guitar or something like that.
So
I just kept doing it, and then as I got better, different opportunities opened up, and I became noted for my stand-up, and then I made some short films with some people, and that led to a sketch comedy show on MTV called Human Giant that I did for two seasons.
What's up? I'm Surya.
Michael.
Michael. What's Michael want?
Tadpole wants to swim with the big fish.
Oh, boy, you think you got what it takes, huh? We'll take a on Mount Rushmore and call me Jefferson, buddy. This place will eat you up.
How important is it for you to write and develop your own projects, like Human Giant, the MTV sketch comedy?
I think it's super important. That's what I'm doing right now with films. I'm developing a few films for me to shoot next time I have a hiatus from Parks and Rec. And not a lot of scripts out there are really funny. And then if a script is funny, the chances of there being something for me to do that fits me well, it's hard. So it's better. You have a lot better odds if you develop stuff yourself and, go for it.
I once heard you say that one of the things you're really proud of with your character on Parks and Recreation, Tom Haverford, that he could be played by anybody. I don't know if I believe that, but you said it's not a role specifically for an Indian actor. And I think the same can be said for Chet, the character in 30 Minutes or Less. Is that important to you? Do you not want to be sort of, pigeonholed as an Indian actor playing an Indian role?
I just am very happy when I'm able to take roles from white actors. So, if a part's written for a white guy and then I get cast,
you want
I'm
it.
Really proud of myself. It's like a victory for all minorities.
Well, in all seriousness, ethnic-based humor, some comedians do sort of get rooted in it. Some could say stuck in it. Do you feel when you head on a stage to do stand-up, are people, your audience is just expecting an Indian comic?
Not anymore. I think I've done so much stuff that people kind of know my style of comedy. My comedy, especially my stand-up, it's really just about whatever's going on in my life. You know what I mean? It's much more personal. If I do anything about my ethnicity, I'm very specific about it. In the last special that I did, I told a story about how I was doing an interview and someone asked me if I was really excited about the success of Slumdog Millionaire. And to me, that was an interesting idea to explore in stand-up. I was doing an interview once, and this guy goes, you must be pretty psyched by all this Slumdog Millionaire stuff. And I was like, yeah, I am. I have no idea why, though. I had nothing to do with that movie. It's just some people that kind of look like me are in this movie that everyone loves and winning Oscars and stuff. And I was like, whoa. Are white people just psyched all the time? It's like, Back to the Future, that's us. Godfather, that's us. Godfather Part 2, that's us. Departed, that's us. Sunset Boulevard, that's us. Citizen Kane, that's us. Jaws, that's us. Every movie but Slumdog Millionaire and Boys in the Hood is us.
A lot of comedians will say there's nothing like doing stand-up. Is that where you're most comfortable?
I don't know if it's where I'm most comfortable, but that, I mean, if I had to pick one that to do the rest of my life, it would probably be that, I think. But this year, I pretty much just did stand-up and lived in New York and was, like, writing stand-up and touring. And I was like, wow, like, even if, you know, I got fired off Parks and no one ever wanted me to do a movie again, I could just do this and I would be extremely happy. And I would make a living that I'm really pleased with.
Well, I want to talk about the new film, 30 Minutes or Less. It's just released nationwide on Friday. I saw the film. It's absolutely nuts. I mean, it's like 90 minutes of absolute craziness.
Okay, here we are. We get the handguns or the Uzis. What do you think?
These look pretty real.
Get down on Get down on the ground and give me the money in the bank.
Oh, wait, how am I supposed to get you the money if I'm on the ground?
Go get the money in the bank and then get down on the ground afterwards.
All right, I'll be right back.
It's pretty funny. You guys were not exactly professional bank robbers doing this.
No, I mean, part of the fun of that movie was that the characters are these guys that watch all these action movies all the time, you know, movies like Die Hard or Point Break and things like that. So when they rob the bank, they kind of, you know, are trying to get into the mode of these characters they've seen in movies that they watch.
And no offense, you're not like screaming Bruce Willis when you're robbing that bank.
Yeah, that's what's funny about it is I'm not Keanu Reeves. I'm Aziz. Right. So it's not really intimidating.
And your first leading film role, really. I mean, you were on screen almost this in the entire 90 minutes.
Yep, I'm my brown bearded face on that screen the whole time.
Well, I mean, making movies, stand-up, sitcom, I mean, what else is left? And what do you still want to add to the repertoire?
My R&B album.
You have to drop us a little R&B before we let you go. I mean, if that's where you want to go eventually.
I don't know if I can do that for you today, David.
It's actor-comedian Aziz Ansari, up-and-coming R&B star and current star of the new film, 30 Minutes or Less, which is in theaters now. Check it out. He joined me from our NPR West studios. Aziz Ansari, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, if Aziz likes to sing so much, I've got some advice for the comedian. He should hitch a ride sometime with Joel Laguido. Joel's a cab driver in Arlington, Virginia. Jump in his back seat and he'll ask you two questions. Where are you going? And do you want the mic? Joel is known as the karaoke cabbie. He's got two small monitors for reading the lyrics and a big silver microphone in his cab. I had to check it out. And so Joel agreed to pick me up outside our studios here in Washington. Here's that ride. Are you Joel?
Yeah, I'm Joel.
I'm David. Nice to meet
David,
you.
David, nice to meet you.
You're the karaoke cab.
Yeah, it's me.
I wanna lay you down on a bed of roses. For tonight, I sleep on a bed of this.
Why did you want to do this?
Because I have a microphone, I sing in the house, and then I'm trying to put in the car.
For you? So it started
for me,
out.
Yeah,
you
but for me. Yeah, to, for me.
You sang karaoke at home, and you were like, "I should do this while I'm driving."
Yeah.
And then did a passenger just sort of see it and say, "Hey,
yeah,
hey,
my the
turn."
Passenger, yeah. The passenger said, "Oh, I wanna sing." My boy.
Not everyone likes to sing, and so I was curious to see what happens when Joel picks up passengers. We rolled up to a bar.
Hey. Karaoke cab, you want to get in?
We're going like literally two blocks.
That's great. You got to sing. Here's the microphone.
Okay.
Whoever's, it's all you.
The summer of 69, me and some guys from school.
You're the expert. Do you think people who have had some drinks sing,
yeah,
they sing better?
Some people, when I pick up and I have karaoke, they don't like to sing. And then they get my number. And then after like 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock, They called me, and after that, they shot in my car. You see, need more liquid in the body first. Yeah. Those were the best days of my
life. Oh yeah. After those crooners got out of the cab, Joel and I did one final number together.
Here we go.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. Whisper word of wisdom, let it be, yeah.
The Potomac River has never looked so pretty as tonight. I have to say that, Joel.
Thank you, everybody. See you next year.
It's time for a history lesson. Shall we say a super history lesson? This one from Grant Morrison, one of the world's most revered comic book writers. He's worked for both DC and Marvel Comics, and he's written the words of Superman, Batman, and other heroes. If you're a fan of comic books, well, Grant Morrison is sort of like a god. Exhibit A, the faces of some of my colleagues who are pressed against the glass of the studio right now, waving their arms around. If, like me, you don't spend a whole lot of time paging through comic books, you're about to hear what comic book characters might tell us about everything from American history to cross-dressing. Grant Morrison's new book is Super Gods: What Masked Vigilantes, Miraculous Mutants, and a Sun God from Smallville Can Teach Us About Being Human. Grant Morrison joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
So I guess we all have the image of the comic book, superheroes on the page and the bubble quotes. You were a kid growing up in Scotland. What brought you into this world?
It was kind of weird. I mean, I guess what really got me into it was my mother was a big fan of science fiction. And her father had been a fan of science fiction, and that was quite unusual for working class people in Scotland and, you know, pre-war. But certainly, my parents were anti-nuclear activists, so the big fear in my house was the bomb. And as a kid, I was terrified of the bomb, you know, it was just this thing that would kill us all. And then I discovered Superman. And those comic books had characters who could laugh at the bomb. You know, Superman could take the atom bomb in his face and shake it off and only get a tan. So I kind of really attached myself to those guys because they helped me make a lot of sense out of that.
Why wouldn't a working class family in Scotland be into science fiction?
It just wasn't done. It was seen as frivolous, you know, particularly in Scotland, which is very down to earth, very grounded, and people didn't like the fanciful. They liked crazy humour. But if you were into, say, American superheroes, it was seen as slightly suspect, you know, the idea that you would take any of this ridiculous nonsense seriously.
Yeah. You wrote that the first glimpse of Superman was really deliberately ambiguous, not necessarily flying. Describe for us that very first issue of Action Comics where we first meet Superman.
Well, the first image of Superman appears without any copy at all. You know, the comic was Action Comics. It was number one. No one had ever seen this thing before. And on the front, there's a guy dressed in a cape and tights, smashing a car off a rock while three other men run in every possible direction to get away from him. And so that very first appearance of Superman, we've no idea if he's a hero at all, if he's on our side. I mean,
we don't know whether to fear him, to like him, to
exactly,
what he's up to.
Exactly, you know, and he's destroying a car, which at the time was kind of a symbol of America's technological superiority. You know, normally we would have seen those cars rolling off the production belts at Ford. Instead, here was a man actually picking one up and destroying it quite flamboyantly.
Well, after we see the success of Superman, a lot of comic book writers wanted to jump in and try to recreate that. And you write that the answer was Batman.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it was almost reversing the polarity. What defined this character and made him different from Superman?
I think a lot of it was very calculated. You know, as I said in the book, Batman is so much an obvious opposite of Superman that it's quite clear that somebody just sat down and broke it all down and put it back together again.
In the opposite way?
Pretty much, you know, and Superman's a solar hero. He gets his power from the sun, so Batman hangs out at night. You know, Superman works alone and he has no partners. Batman has a boy partner.
You say that Batman was like the Rolling Stones to Superman's Beatles.
Yeah, because Batman was cool. You know, Superman had a boss and he worked in a job and the girl across in the other side of the office didn't like him. Batman has a butler. He sleeps in all day. You know, he's surrounded by all these girls in leather who are constantly chasing him and trying to get off with him and or kill him. So it's kind of, as I said in the book, it's the capitalist superhero versus the socialist superhero. It's the socialist versus the socialite.
Right.
And I think it's why Batman's been more popular recently, because in our culture, it's, you know, it's much more aspirational to be a billionaire success than it is to be a farm worker or a newspaper reporter. So we've kind of become the sort of people who would rather have Batman or Iron Man.
I'm speaking with comic book writer Grant Morrison in his new book, Super Gods, is in bookstores right now. Grant, can we talk about cross-dressing?
Sure, we can. as soon as possible.
Of course. Jimmy Olsen was worked for the Daily Planet alongside Clark Kent, alongside Superman, and he starts dressing like a woman, Jimmy Olsen
What was that about?
I have no idea. Again, it was those stories in the 50s where instead of trying to deal with the real world, which, you know, Superman had started out doing in the Depression, it was very real. It was real gangsters, real politicians. But in the 50s, it just went insane. So Jimmy would be dressed as a girl and then he'd be forced to, you know, have a date with an ape. And the piling up of madness and surrealism would just get more and more grotesque until somehow Superman would come along at the end and with some very easy explanation, it would all go back to normality.
Well, you yourself decided to cross-dress for a while, and you say it sort of shaped your writing in many ways. What was going on?
I'd reached 30, and I'd had a fairly cloistered life. You know, I'd grown up wanting to write, and I'd went to a boys' school, so I kind of spent most of my teenage years just learning to write and being indoors, you know, a proper kind of geek existence.
Cooped up.
Yeah, so although I'd, you know, in my 20s I was in a band and lots of other things had happened, I was with a very nice girl, I felt as if I hadn't done a lot of things, so I went a bit nutty at 30 and decided to do a lot of the stuff that I hadn't ever tried, like drinking and
cross-dressing,
for instance. But I was doing a comic called The Invisibles, and one of the characters one of the characters was a cross-dressing transvestite shaman from Brazil. So I thought, well, I'm going to learn what it's like to be a transvestite shaman.
And what's the lesson for aspiring writers? I mean, if you want to write about a transvestite witch, do you, as a writer, need to become one?
I think all writers should do that. I think if Stephen King wants to write his next book about a transvestite witch, he really needs to wear a dress.
I have to say, when I first heard that we were doing this interview, I'm not a comic book guy, and I was kind of like, you know, the old dusty comic books people collected. What's going to be fresh about that? You've taught me a lot. But for those of us who are not in the comic book world, give us the argument for why we should give comics a chance, why I should go out today and buy some comic books and get to reading.
Well, the easy argument is that they are as good as anything else you might look at. In fact, they're better than most things. You know, good comic books are as good as your favourite movie, as good as your favourite record, as good as your favourite TV show, and are well worth being on the pop culture diet of any smart, you know, adult who's living in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. They're very specific way of dealing with the world. You know, other things like movies and TV shows take years to make. A comic is on the streets within 3 months of it being created. There's very little editorial influence, so you're seeing artists work directly on the page. So I think the real value of comic book stories and of the movie stories and of everything that we've talked about superheroes over the last 70 years is actually to provide role models for a new generation that will be so far beyond as we've only considered it in these ridiculous stories. And the fact that at least there was an outlet for this is we've kind of tested the idea to destruction. So when new superheroes appear on the planet, real superheroes, they'll have all this material to study and kind of figure out what are we supposed to be and do.
And real superheroes will be arriving soon?
They're here already. I mean, there's people on the streets wearing costumes fighting crime right now, and they're fighting crime without superpowers. But, you know, give those guys bionic legs, give them, like, X-ray eyes, and wait to see what happens
next.
That
really kicks some butt.
Yeah.
Well, Grant Morrison tells us we should all go while away an afternoon reading a comic book. If you want to while away an afternoon, you can also read his new book, Super Gods, What Masked Vigilantes, Miraculous Mutants, and a Sun God from Smallville Can Teach Us About Being Human, and it's out in bookstores now. Grant Morrison, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much. That was great.
Time now for music. And a group that's worked hard to live up to its self-proclaimed nickname, the best band on the planet. These are the Bottle Rockets. Straight from 12th grade into junior college, buddy, 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 I passed my exam. Whatever you do, don't call them a bar band. That's a title the band is not very fond of. While the lyrics are simple and straightforward, their songs can rock hard or quietly capture the pain of poverty.
It's a pure, perfect world. You see, it tells no lies. It'll burn you down, you try it, improvise.
This is from their new live acoustic album called Not So Loud, an acoustic evening with the Bottle Rockets. And with me now is the front man of the Bottle Rockets, Brian Henneman. He joins us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Brian, welcome.
Hey, good to be here.
You guys, the Bottle Rockets, you were once described as the thinking person's hillbilly bar band. What
now,
do you take issue with?
Out?
What do you take issue with most? The hillbilly, the bar, which, or both?
Well, you know, hillbilly, we're not hillbillies. Never have been hillbillies. And bar band, I mean, we were saddled with that simply because we predominantly played in bars, but I think we're probably the worst bar band in America because you have to pay attention to us.
Well, whose stories are you telling?
Anyone from our area, the Midwest, you know. It's kind of like where we live. It's what we know. It's what we sing about.
I can't do nothing for myself. My baby's upset as if I don't get better. She's going to break my neck, but I'm sleeping in late. I just say, what the heck, this is my dream come true. Doing nothing, getting a check. I fell down, so here I lay.
When did you start to think about, God, I can tell some of these personal stories in song?
Well, it kind of came to me by default in that I was in a band that actually had a lead singer and songwriter. He left the band, and we were left with the remainder of the band. And since nobody else would step up to the plate, I ended up doing it. So then I started looking at music a whole different way from a songwriter standpoint. But I only was able to do it by talking about what I knew about.
A small town laboring man, I got lucky this time with the right diamond joke. If this happened last month, no compensation, no joke.
Well, what makes you want to tell the stories of people in workman's comp and hard on their luck and sort of, you know, the everyday stories of Americana?
They don't get sung about much. It's kind of a wide open palette, really. It's usually what gets looked over, or it gets, in modern new country, they cartoon it up.
And you grew up in the middle, in a small town outside St. Louis.
Right.
These stories, do they capture the type of life that you had?
There's very little fiction in anything we do. Everything's sort of like a police report of the situation.
I want to bring up Smoking 100s Alone. Sounds like a woman in a pretty sad state.
What's funny is it's one of the only songs we've ever done that is actually fiction.
Ah.
So, yeah, it was a friend of mine came up with the title while we were sitting in a restaurant. He was looking across the table at me, and he goes, "Ooh, she's smoking 100s alone." And I just thought, oh, there's a song title.
Another cup of coffee down the hatch. Another cigarette soon as she finds a match. Feeling more like the loser as each minute drags on. Oh, she's smoking 100s alone.
I'm speaking with Brian Henneman, who's frontman for the band Bottle Rockets, and their new record is called Not So Loud, an acoustic evening with the Bottle Rockets. And I heard you speaking on the new album before one of the songs, and you said that your parents had a tremendous influence on you, and your mom and dad died in the same year.
Right. They died 6 weeks apart in 1999, which was pretty heavy, heavy duty. Looking back on it, I think it was the best way for it to happen. But, yeah, you know, it's like I lived with my parents, you know, for longer than a guy should.
How long are we talking here, Brian?
Being a musician, oh, I was in and out, you know, well through my 20s. So, you know, it was like I was the slacker in the basement, more or less, in between travel and road shows. But, you know, they're your parents. Of course they're influential if you, you know, unless they're doing things that drive you away from them, which mine never did.
Mom and Dad, where have you gone? I'm here at your house, and I just mowed your lawn. Ah, but nobody's home now but me.
I wonder just where you could be.
How did your mom and dad influence you, Brian, and how do you still feel them?
They didn't really clamp down on me when I took off in the guitar playing direction. They, you know, let me go ahead and do it. They weren't the kind of parents that were like, well, you have to get a real job, you have to fall back on this, or you have to do that. Might have been wise of them to do that. But they didn't. And when I didn't make enough money to have a home, they let me have one. And they were not musical people at all. So, yeah, just being folks that let me take off on my thing. That was their hugest influence.
You've played with some pretty big names. You were in a band called Uncle Tupelo.
Yes and yes, I was, and no, I wasn't. I was, okay. I was like the guy that that nobody ever really knew what my position was there. So I was like the all purpose. I was like Country Bob's all purpose sauce with that band, you know. Just
but with a musician like Jeff Tweedy. I mean, it's. I guess I'm wondering now that you're in the Bottle Rockets, you guys have become. You've become big. You're not as commercial, as big as Wilco.
Right.
I mean, what takes you to the next level if you're trying to get there?
It's too late to go to the next level. We're too comfortable where we're at. Why would we want to move now? It's just everything will just be more of a pain in the butt. So, yeah, no, this is a real awesome, comfortable place, and we like it. And by golly, that's our story, and we're sticking to it.
I can't let you go without asking you about your guitar.
Which one?
Well, I heard you have one that's made of trash.
Oh, the trash picker, of course. That's an awesome. I got to plug Creston Lee, Burlington, Vermont.
Okay.
Creston Electric Instruments. Okay.
And he made your trash guitar?
Oh yeah, it was a fun project. I had a bunch of spare parts, and I sent it to him.
Like spare parts just from cars or instruments?
No,
or
just musical instrument parts.
Okay.
And I mailed them to him in a case, and I said, the only rule is you have to use only materials that you were going to throw away anyway. You have to use everything I sent you, and you have to make it fit within this case. Every piece of it is something that was destined for the dumpster, and it turned into a great guitar.
I've been traveling over my...
Brian Henneman, he's the lead vocalist and guitarist of the Bottle Rockets, their latest, called Not So Loud, comes out on Tuesday, but you can hear a few tracks of it right now at our website, nprmusic.org. Brian Henneman, this has been fun. Take care of that trash guitar. It was good talking to you.
Oh, yeah, I treasure my garbage guitar.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, it's not, I don't love her, and the Lord knows that I do.
And that's the podcast edition of The Best of Weekends on All Things Considered. Our program is directed today by Petra Mayer and produced by Phil Harrell, with Kenya Young, Brent Bachman, Lily Percy, Lauren Silverman, and Megan Kane. Daniel Shukin is our technical director. Rick Holter is our senior editor. This is sadly the last week for our intern, Kevin Lasky. He has been so valuable, I will tell you that the staff is going to do its best to put up a roadblock so he's unable to make it back to college and will stay put here. Honestly, we thank you, Kevin. It has been a tremendous honor working with the incredibly talented staff of this program. I am hoping that they invite me back at some point. I'd love to work with them again soon. Next week, my friend Lara Sullivan is your host. You can hear this program on your local public radio station in most places at 5 p.m. each Saturday and Sunday. That's the podcast for this week. I'm David Green. We'll be back with a brand new podcast next weekend. As always, thanks for listening.